Hello, dear listener. Jim Stroud here, awaiting. I'm awaiting for Courtney, who will join us really soon to interview our next guest. And she should, oh, wait, just got an email from Courtney. Courtney says, Jim, I am assisting our client and cannot be with you today. Sorry. Oh, no. Oh, no. That means that I will have to be here. Not that that's a bad thing. I enjoy it. But it means that Courtney will not be here to interview our next guest. Actually, I will be here to interview our next guest. And our next guest is, let's see here. Another email from Courtney. Jim, in case you don't know who the next guest is, here is a reminder. Courtney, you know me so well. All right, let me read some of the notes here that Courtney sent me about our next guest. Let's see here. New and amended employment law seem to be constantly on the rise in the United States, and 2021 will be no different. Employers must stay current with these new regulations or possibly face substantial liability through employee lawsuits and agency changes. With this in mind, we will talk with Paul Kramer, Director of Compliance at Workforce Software, to discuss what businesses should know about compliance and employment laws at the outset of 2021. Employment laws. I wonder if I should bring up politics. I probably shouldn't, but I probably will right after this special message. You are listening to Tribe Pod, a podcast series of interviews of interest to the HR community. It is hosted by Courtney Lane, produced by Jim Stroud, sponsored by Proactive Talent, and enjoyed by you. Today's episode begins right after this.
On-demand recruiting is an hourly service that we offer where our recruiters work as an extension of your business, helping to fill your positions by finding top talent.
So on-demand recruiting is there to address issues in hiring when a company is experiencing a lot of growth, when they're having some seasonality changes, where they may temporarily need to expand their recruiting team. You maybe have a new line of business or a space where you're expanding your business and you need to bring in specialty expertise to help fill those niche roles that your internal team may not yet be ramped up on.
Proactive Talent's on-demand recruiting solution is quite different from a lot of the other models that you're going to see in the workplace. Whereas you're going to pay a contingency recruiting firm, typically on average around 20%, sometimes up to 30% of the first year salary of the person that you hire. And in that same period of time, you'll spend less than a quarter of that with Proactive Talent's managed on-demand.
For more information on Proactive Talent, visit them online at proactivetalent.com or click the link in the podcast description. So hello, sir. Thank you for being a guest on Tribe Pod. If you would, tell us who you are and what you do.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Paul Kramer, and I'm the Director of Compliance for Workforce Software. Since 1999, Workforce Software has been in the business of helping employers reduce the burdens and risks associated with employment laws, regulations, policies, and rules through software configuration in the areas of time and attendance, leaves of absences, forecasting, scheduling, fatigue management, and workforce analytics. We're the only vendor focused on purely workforce management for enterprise customers, and we partner with all the big human capital management players such as SAP, Oracle, and Workday. What differentiates us from our competitors is our rules engine. We make work easy for customers with a flexible system that can be configured to manage all the unique scenarios in their workforce, such as unique overtime rules or unique leave laws rules. Now, as Director of Compliance for the past 10 years, my duties include ensuring that our products comply with the law by researching and monitoring employment laws in the United States, Canada, and elsewhere around the world. Before joining Workforce Software, I worked for more than 20 years as a private attorney, representing employers of all sizes in employment law matters. And in this time, I've dealt with leave laws, wage and hour laws, payroll requirements, scheduling, and a variety of other employment issues. I've also written on employment law topics and presented in webinars and seminars. So that's me.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. I do appreciate it. I've been involved in recruiting off and on for a couple of decades, even though I sort of scratched my head wondering where the time went. Usually when I hear the word compliance, people get nervous and they get scared. For those who may have heard the word compliance mentioned here and there, but not quite sure what you mean by that, can you explain what compliance is?
Sure. By compliance, I simply mean complying with the law. There's, you know, thousands of employment laws out there that organizations, employers, public entities have to comply with. And so when I say compliance, that is what I'm talking about. Employers complying with employment and labor laws.
Interesting. There's a lot where there's no shortage of controversy in our news today with so much going on. One of the controversies that I've been hearing a lot about, and of course, I'm not the expert, you are, but I hear a lot about how there's a possibility of companies potentially compelling their employees to get a vaccination shot in order to work at certain places. Is that legal to do, or is that being decided, or what's your take on all that?
Under EEOC guidance, and by EEOC, I mean the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, employers may require vaccinations as long as there are certain exceptions and the vaccinations are consistent with business necessity. Exceptions must be made for employees who cannot be vaccinated because of sincerely held religious beliefs or because of a disability. But what I want you to keep in mind is this is just guidance. The final say is always a court of law. So, you know, courts generally will follow guidance issued by agencies like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or the Department of Labor, but they don't necessarily have to. So until a court actually makes a ruling on some type of vaccination issue, that is when you will ultimately find out. But there is guidance at this point suggesting that as long as employers comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act and people's religious freedom, that vaccinations would be lawful.
Interesting. It just sounds like it would be a PR nightmare for a company to compel someone to take a vaccination. And then, God forbid, they get sick behind it, which isn't necessarily a fault of the company because they didn't make the vaccine, but it could look really bad for a company if they, if they encourage their employees to get the shot and then they start getting sick. If that were to happen, do employees have a legal recourse, as far as you know, to go against the company? They say, you made me take this shot and now I'm sick, so I'm going to sue the vaccine company and you.
Let me put it this way. And I've told this to many clients over the years. Employers, anybody can always be sued. How it would end up, I don't know, but employers have it tough from both ends. If they don't require or don't suggest or don't recommend vaccinations and somebody catches COVID-19 and they can trace it back to the workplace, there might be an issue there. So no matter which way you go, there's going to be an issue. But as far as your ultimate question, you know, I'm sorry, but anybody can be sued for anything.
Yeah, I guess it's a matter of you can sue anybody for anything, but will you win and will you collect the damages if you do? I guess those are different questions as well.
They are different questions. Collecting the damage is always the most important.
Right. I guess you can always sue a ham sandwich if you wanted to.
Exactly.
At the same time. Transitioning to a less controversial topic, politics. Now, I've also have read consistently about how people are nervous about their political beliefs and whether or not they could be fired for their political opinion. Is there a compliance issue around that where companies can't force somebody not to speak about politics, or is that just something they can advise? What's the deal around that, you think?
Well, I'm going to take it to the basic level. I don't see why anybody would discuss politics in the workplace. There's always going to be, nowadays, people don't convince anybody of anything. And people seem to have strong feelings on both sides.
Sure.
And so it could lead to some type of, you know, workplace disruption, workplace argument. So, you know, my recommendation, just to employees, just for the sake of a well-functioning workplace, I don't know why politics would be discussed.
Reminds me of a previous policy, don't ask, don't tell, although it's applied to something else. It seems like it's a good policy right now. Don't ask me, I won't tell you.
I do remember that policy, and you're right, that's a whole different issue.
Do you have any examples of companies that may have presumably were aware that they needed to be compliant, but they did not maybe treat it as seriously as they should have, and they were penalized heavily for it? Any cautionary tales?
I think my cautionary tale would be for employers to keep their personal feelings out of decisions. And by that, I mean, if there's something going on in the workplace, whether or not it's compliance with a leave law or something else. And let's just say they're dealing with an employee who has for 7 or 8, 10 years been a pain in the rear.
Right.
Okay. All employers have those employees. They may have suspected in the past that this employee, you know, may not have been honest with them, or whatever the issue is. They may have suspected things, not been able to prove it or whatever, but they just have their suspicions about this worker. But if a worker makes a request for leave and gives a reason for the request for leave, simply because your personal feelings are that you don't believe this employee because of things that have happened in the past, you should treat this as a whole new thing. The employee, though they might not have been honest in the past or whatever, they may be honest this time. So you have to basically go into things like this with an open mind and treat the employee like he's making a legitimate request, ask them to submit the certifications they may need for the leave. Then once you get all the evidence in, then you may be able to make a determination. But employers should just not assume that, you know, because something has been some way in the past, all of a sudden that's how it is now.
So I'm thinking of a situation where somebody asked for extended leave because they were injured, some sort of disability they're claiming. And then on Facebook, they post their ski trip. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
That is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Employers have a lot of things, you know, they do if they don't trust an employee. They have to be careful when they do that, but sometimes they do surveillance, or sometimes they check out people's, you know, Facebook or wherever, their social media thing. And that's really, you know, an important, first of all, I think all employees should be honest. Okay. You know, as a lesson to some employees who may not be honest out there, they should keep in mind that, you know, employers go on the web, go on the internet as much as anybody else, you know, and you never know what somebody can discover.
That's interesting. So if I am suspicious of my employee, let's call him Dilbert, and I maybe as a manager, I just don't like him, but I can't really let that affect how I manage them. But out of curiosity, I start stalking their Twitter and their Facebook, and I see things that they say or do that I don't like personally. And I think that, okay, because this person thinks a certain way or he's posting certain materials online, that's a reason enough for me to consider putting him on a performance and program maybe, or consider firing him in some kind of way. I'm assuming that's totally illegal, but I know that some managers probably do that. And I say that because earlier this year, when the coronavirus pandemic hit and people started working from home all of a sudden, there was this huge rush of people management buying these surveillance tools that would go on someone's computer to monitor their employee, which I thought was really interesting, because not only are you increasing your monitoring of your employee, they're also working at home. So you're getting insight into their personal life. And it should be like some sort of line drawn of how much a manager can surveil an employee. And then I think also, and I'll say this and let you comment. I also think as well that if someone's working from home, they're probably not working consistent 9 to 5. So they may do a few hours here and there and then do something late at night. So it's like you can't make the argument of I'm watching you from 9 to 5 when you could work literally all day and night at different hours of the day. It seemed like it was just sort of a HR nightmare, but I'm rambling. I'll let you interject somewhere in there.
Well, the point, you said a lot of things there.
Yeah, I did. I'm sorry.
No, you have to apologize. I found what you were saying was very interesting. The part that you really said that interested me the most, actually, was what you said at the end, that when employees are working from home, they might not be working, the same hours as it did before. So, for example, when you worked in the office, you worked 9 to 5, we'll just say. But when you're at home, maybe for whatever reasons, something happens with kids at home, you might be working 3 hours here, 4 hours there, whatever. In that situation, it's very important, and this is what should be emphasized to employers with people working at home, especially if they're the types of employees that have to submit timesheets demonstrate to the employer what their hours are. Mm-hmm. Employers have to, more than ever nowadays, be cognizant of the fact to require employees to submit their hours on a regular basis so that employers have a valid basis in order to pay them. I think you generally know that if you work more than 40 hours in a week under the Fair Labor Standards Act, you're entitled to overtime pay, which is time and a half. Because with the weird hours, employers, it's more important than ever that employees submit their timesheets and keep track of their time so that employers will properly be paying their employees, because one thing you do not want to do is not properly pay your employees when they work overtime, because the Department of Labor can go back 2 or 3 years, depending on if it's deemed to be an intentional violation. Mm-hmm. You can go back 3 years or otherwise 2 years. And, that can add up to a lot of money, especially if it involves more than one employee. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I think that's key, the keeping of time records while the employee is not working in the office.
That's interesting to me, because I am thinking of times where I'm at a grocery store, Publix or someplace, and while I'm in line, I'm checking my email at work. I'm replying to emails while I'm at work. I might send a Slack message to somebody, a coworker, knowing they probably won't get it till tomorrow, but I did it after working hours. And it seems like, would that be an issue potentially for a company if they are audited at some point and they say, and someone says, well, Jim was working after hours, even though he was checking email and sending messages, would that necessarily count? Should companies have a rule that says, don't even email me after a certain time?
Jim, You bring up interesting subjects. I'll give you that much. Yes, it is an issue. Okay. And it is, in my opinion, it is good for employers to have a policy in which they advise or inform their non-exempt employees that they should not be working once they leave the workplace, or, you know, whatever, that they have to have permission to work overtime, something like that, because their hours can get out of control. And you're right, even something as minimal as sending an email, a work-related email. I don't send too many emails. You know, I'm the kind of guy, probably you are, probably a lot of people are, where they try to make their emails sound somewhat intelligent. They just don't. And so I put thought into it and I type it. A lot of people do. So it's proper English, you know, all things like that. So it takes time. So if you spend 6 minutes drafting an email, that's a tenth of an hour. That employee, in essence, should be paid a tenth of an hour for that. Now, if you have a rule in your employee handbook that an employee should not be working outside of hours, and they do an email and they submit their time sheet, I would still pay them for the time they worked. But in that case, you could discipline them for violating the company policy about working outside of hours. So it is good to put something like that in your handbook, but you're right. Even things as minimal as, you know, short emails should be paid for. Now, there's a rule out there called the de minimis rule, which is under the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, where sometimes if work covers such a small amount of time, perhaps you may not have to pay them for that or count that as hours worked. But the problem with that is, yeah, one email is 3 minutes, but suppose you do three quick emails and it's 10 minutes. A lot of times employees just don't do one thing for 2 minutes. They'll do a few things, and in that case, the time adds up. You know, I'll give you another example of a real work situation. A young lady, a client many years ago, was working for a school district. She was, I believe, I can't recall her job title. I don't know if it was paraeducator or teaching. I think it was just teaching assistant. And every day when work got done at 3 p.m. or whatever time it was, she was asked to walk some young kids out to the bus. Well, that took 10 minutes. You know, and she would have to stand there till everybody's on the bus. Sure, that would take 10 or 15 minutes a day. But her pay, they quit paying her at 3. And so if you add up 10 minutes a day or 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and you add that up during an entire semester, that can add up to one heck of a lot of money.
Wow. Wow. If you put like all companies in the world in a basket, well, not in the world, in the United States in a basket, what percentage would you say take the time to do risk assessment of stuff just like this? I mean, my thinking is that they're probably like the top 100 companies maybe, but everybody else know. I mean, what do you think?
You know, I don't know. I'm just going to be honest with you. I don't know the percentage of companies that do that. There's a lot of good companies out there, and thankfully I work for one of them. And there's a lot of companies out there that do want to treat their employees well. But I am aware of I'll call this statistic that I see issued. Oh, I read it sometime in the last 2 or 3 years from the Department of Labor, that 70% of employers were in one way or another not complying with the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the Fair Labor Standards Act is the federal wage and hour law in the United States. Now, it's probably not intentional. I really, in my career, haven't met too many employers that will intentionally violate the law as their employees. You know, I'm sure other employees may give you a different story from certain in certain cases, but I'm just talking to you from my point of view. I haven't seen it, but unfortunately, there's more complications in the law than a lot of employers know. And so they inadvertently do not follow the Fair Labor Standards Act. Let me give you a quick example.
Please.
At the beginning of a year, an employer announces, at the end of the year, we will be giving employees, all employees who are still with us, a $5,000 bonus. So they have announced it. Mm-hmm. That is what you call a non-discretionary bonus. The employer has told them they're getting it. Once they're told they're getting it, they probably even put it in writing. Once they're told they're getting it, it makes a non-discretionary bonus. That non-discretionary bonus should be used in calculating what an employee's overtime rate is. But a lot of employers don't know that that bonus should be included in the regular rate when determining overtime, so they're inadvertently paying their employees wrong. And there's a lot of laws out there. I think that's one of the first things I said in this conversation we're having. Mm-hmm. There's state law, there's federal law, there's state law. Then there's a lot of times cities have their own laws. And it's not just limited to big cities. It can be smaller, medium-sized cities have their own laws. And so employers may be complying with the federal law because that's what they know about, but they don't know there's a state law and another local law dealing with the same issue that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, they're complying with the federal law, but there's still a lot of compliance because the state law is more protective of the employee, so in essence, they're violating the law. Another example is the Family and Medical Leave Act. That is the federal family leave law in the United States. Everybody is aware of that. But states have their own. Many states, like California, have their own state family and medical leave laws that are different from the federal law. And one state's family and medical leave law is going to be different from another state's family and medical leave law. Mm-hmm. And so if you have an employer who's in many states around the country, they not only have to comply with the federal Family and Medical Leave Act, but they're going to have to play, if they're in California, they have employees in California, they'll be complying with the California's state family medical leave law. Then if they have employees in Connecticut, they have to be aware of that family medical leave law. And some employers think, well, if I'm complying with Connecticut's and I'm applying with California's, no, it doesn't work like that. These laws are all different. And mm-hmm. so you have to know the details of each of these laws in order to know whether or not you're compliant.
Yeah, and then I imagine you also have to think about how you might misclassify a worker. If you treat an hourly worker like a permanent worker, that might get into some issues too, I imagine. It does.
The Fair Labor Standards Act has pretty set way about whether or not an employee is exempt or non-exempt. It's almost formulistic. Mm-hmm. you got to meet these elements. And unfortunately, yes, sometimes employers, because sometimes it's not clear whether or not someone falls under an overtime exemption or not. So an employer might think they're exempted from overtime, and in reality, they're not. So you have a worker who they're paying a salary who's been working 50 hours a week, and they should have been paying them overtime, and they aren't because they misclassified the employee. Well, if that employee finds a lawyer, he can go back years, two or three years, add up all the hours that he wasn't paid overtime, and recover a lot of money from the employer. And what's key is this, too, when it comes to mistakes made by employer. If an employer is making a mistake as to one employee, mm-hmm. and if they're a company of 5 or 6, 10,000 employees, if they're making a mistake as one employee, chances are they're making the same mistake to the other 3,000 employees in the same position, because chances are they're not doing it on purpose. They're just making a mistake. So not only would they owe the back wages to the one person you and I have been talking about, but then mm-hmm. there's these other 2 or 3 or 4,000 employees that they've been making the same mistake on. And so when you add up the damages that could come from improperly paying an 3 or 4,000 employees going back 2 or 3 years, then you really start talking about a lot of money. But let's talk about a different type of classification that I think is going to be really hot this year.
Okay.
Whether or not a worker is an employee or an independent contractor.
Ooh, gig worker.
Yeah, like a gig worker, but there's many more independent contractors out there other than Uber and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's an important differentiation because employees are entitled to certain things that an independent contractor may not be entitled to. So, for example, if an employee loses their job, they may be entitled to unemployment compensation, where in all likelihood, that's not going to be true for an independent contractor. If an employee works more than 40 hours a week, an employee is going to be entitled to overtime, whereas an independent contractor will not. Sometimes employees are under a company's policies are entitled to certain benefits that they don't give independent contractors. And in most cases, leave laws apply to employees, but not independent contractors, though I have seen a few leave laws that say they do apply to independent contractors. Hmm. So I believe, you know, we just, that's been a constant battle for a long time. Employees, a worker suing because they claim they were employee and the company's been classifying them as independent contractor.
Uber and Lyft have been in a wrestling match around that.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. And so what happens is, and it's key for right now because we just elected a new president. Mm-hmm. Anytime you change administrations, changes are going to come into play.
Sure.
And one change that I do believe you will be seeing this year is that probably at the state level and federal level, it's going to be an effort to make it more difficult for employers to establish that a worker is an independent contractor as opposed to an employee. I believe that's a trend. I think there's going to be a trend with the new administration to try to protect workers. And so I believe the trend will be to make it more difficult for employers to establish that a worker is an independent contractor as opposed to an employee. Hopefully I've been saying that right. I've been throwing those words around.
This is a lot to keep up with from a management perspective. I mean, but from an employee perspective, I know that companies have the employee handbook and that's sort of like the guiding tool, but are there other ways that companies can encourage their employees to remain compliant to all these different rules, at least the ones that they're aware of?
Employers can occasionally send out memos to employees about an issue, you know, that concerns them and when it comes to compliance. But you're right. Employers should have an employee handbook that sets out in detail what their rules are, what their leave policies are, I think I told you before we joined, I'm coming to you from the state of Michigan. And the state of Michigan does have a regulation indicating that employers have to pay employees in accordance with their policies or regulations. And so it's very important that employers include everything in their handbook. And when they do, make sure they dot all their I's and cross their T's and make sure everything is clear. Because I've read a lot of, you know, contracts in my life and a lot of policies where, you know, I will say to myself, who wrote this thing? You know, it just isn't clear. I mean, I'm as a lawyer trying to understand it, you know, right. And you know how lawyers write, you know, wherefore, sure. Thereas. So you think we'd understand everything, but no, we don't sometimes. So it's very important to be clear in these things.
Have you ever seen someone take an employee handbook to court and say, according to the employee handbook, you said this, but this is what happened. This other thing happened to me.
Oh yeah, that can happen.
Really?
Yeah, that can happen. I have done cases where a handbook has been admitted into evidence. Yes.
Wow.
And just so your listeners know, I did do employment law litigation for about 20 years, close to 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I do have some. But you know what? Let's see. You viewed that. I don't know if you were trying to, but by your question, it indicated that something in writing might be used against the employer. I still am of the belief that employers should put something in writing, because if especially when it comes to like evaluating their workers, or if some type of negative instance happens with an employee, it's always good for the employer to put something like that in writing, because you don't want to get in a situation where it's one person's oral testimony against another, against the company representative's oral testimony. So if an employee goes and takes a witness stand and says, this didn't happen, my employer never talked to me about that. But then you call his supervisor and he brings out a piece of paper saying, here are the notes of that conversation that this employee says we never had. We had it, and this is what we talked about. If you give the jury something in writing to back up what you're saying, that will go a long way towards helping you succeed in your case.
I quite agree. And my experience of watching so many episodes of Judge Judy bears that out.
Well, I'm sad to say I don't watch Judge Judy. So.
Oh, well,
I'm probably missing out. You know what? This is, you can, a little off topic. I do believe sometimes you can learn stuff. I've gotten expressions from TV court shows where I say to myself, hey, that's pretty good. I got to remember that line. So I think you actually can learn some stuff from TV shows.
This has been a great conversation. I think people listening probably have 100 more questions to ask you, more than I have time to relate right now. If somebody wanted to get in contact with you and say, Paul Kramer, I have a dozen questions, how can they get in contact with you?
Well, they can contact me at Workforce Software. My email address is pkramer, that's K-R-A-M-E-R, at workforcesoftware.com. And I'm also pretty busy on Twitter. My name is Workforce Paul, so I am on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn as well, so I'm kind of all over the place.
Gotcha. Well, thanks so much for your insight. It was very valuable and enlightening to me, and I'm sure it was to our listeners as well. Thanks again.
Yeah. Jim, I want to thank you, because you asked some good questions there.
Oh, shucks. Right, that concludes Miss Courtney. That concludes our latest episode of Tripod. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any episode of Tripod, please reach out to us. Our email address is tribepod, TRIBEPOD, at proactivetalent.com. Operators are standing by. And if you want to send Courtney a note and let her know that you missed her too, feel free to send that in email as well. I will send one of my own. All right. That's it for now. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.